by concurring today, we early fund schools and avoid pink slips.
The State House and Senate agree on a school funding plan. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski proposes taxing outdoor recreation gear to fund park projects.
I just want to throw a little bit of a wild card out there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
The Alaska House took a major step today toward preventing layoff notices from going out to teachers and other school workers this spring. The House voted to agree with changes the Senate made to a bill to fund schools separately and before the rest of the budget. Anchorage Democratic Representative Les Guerra voted for the bill. He says it was important to act quickly.
By concurring today, we early fund schools and avoid pink slips. By fighting with the other House for a week or 2 weeks over the language, we missed the pink slip deadline.
The last 2 years, many teachers received layoff notices because the legislature passed the budget later than usual. Not everyone agreed the bill is a good idea. One part of the legislation raised concerns among some minority caucus Republicans. Along with funding for next school year, it also funds the following year. But it would only do that if lawmakers agree on a plan to draw from permanent fund earnings. North Pole Representative Tammy Wilson was one of 9 minority caucus Republicans to vote no. She says tying part of the bill to another piece of legislation is a bad idea.
I can't support tying two bills together. I wish it would have just been a simple bill to where we were talking about funding, which is originally what we were doing.
Lawmakers expect to draw from permanent fund earnings to pay for the state budget for the first time in Alaska history. But they haven't agreed on what the plan will be to make an earnings draw. And until there's an agreement on the permanent fund, one thing that's not clear is how the legislature will pay for schools. The school funding bill will now go to Governor Bill Walker. He praised the bill in a statement after the House passed it. The bill left one other school funding issue unsettled. A separate bill the House passed would increase state aid to schools by boosting the base student allocation, but the Senate hasn't voted on that measure. Senator Lisa Murkowski used a mudslide-prone stretch of the Denali National Park Road to point to the need for more funding to address major maintenance at parks. In July 2016, a slide blocked the park road at Mile 67 through Polychrome Pass, stranding visitors on the other side of the dead-end road. Repairs were made, but the stretch of road remains subject to unstable slopes. Murkowski brought up the issue during a meeting yesterday of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee that she chairs.
We're going to have to do something aggressive here, and rerouting a road in this area is extraordinarily difficult, extraordinarily timely, and extraordinarily expensive. But instead of coming up with a rerouting plan, we're basically using cyclic funds to just kind of patch it.
Murkowski says the Polychrome Pass reroute, which is currently being studied, is not even included on a list of nearly $12 billion in nationwide deferred maintenance projects at parks. Modest entrance fee hikes will help, and Murkowski suggested a federal tax on outdoor recreation gear to help fund park projects.
I just want to throw a little bit of a wild card out there.
Murkowski asked hearing witness REI Government Affairs Director Mark Bereka whether his company and others who benefit from parks would be open to a gear tax. Bereka was not receptive.
You know, most states, they don't tax milk because milk is good for you. And we feel that the outdoors is good for you. So there's no reason to make it harder for people to acquire the things that make their lives better.
Murkowski did not press the issue, but suggested that a gear tax, like revenue from higher park entrance fees, would be a way for users to help ensure park facilities are safe and enjoyable. An Alaska delegation will explore new trade opportunities in China at the end of May. The group includes a baby food maker, several seafood processors, and officials from the Mat-Su Borough. The trip is part of a trade mission that Governor Bill Walker's office announced earlier this year. China is the top consumer of Alaska goods, and Walker says he wants to deepen those ties. On Tuesday, Walker's office announced 26 groups that would travel with the state during the 11-day trip. They'll meet with potential customers and government officials. They'll also be traveling with Alaska's Gasline Development Corporation. The state corporation is working to develop a $45 billion natural gas export project. It wants China to finance the bulk of it. Last night, officials in Anchorage finalized the city's vote count. It's the last step in an election where one of the biggest surprises was the success of the newly implemented vote-by-mail system. More than 79,000 ballots were cast, pushing turnout to just over 36%, a high figure relative to Anchorage's normal local election returns. Assemblymember Eric Croft was one of many to praise the municipal clerk's office, saying the increase in civic engagement is evidence that the new system made voting easier for residents.
We're all impressed on the numbers, but what it means is our prior system didn't work for a lot of people, and we've been bemoaning the lack of participation, and some of it at least, is we didn't make it very easy for people, and we're trying to fix that.
The vote certification upholds what had, up until Tuesday night, been preliminary results. Mayor Ethan Berkowitz won a second term. Ballot Measure 1, related to bathroom regulations, was struck down by a few thousand votes. And the sale of a municipal electrical utility will move forward. The clerk's office says it will continue looking at ways to improve the vote-by-mail system, such as potentially including postage for returning ballots. The assembly is also undergoing a bit of a shakeup in leadership. Longtime chairman Dick Traney is ceding control of the body to a newer member. After a quick vote count, the assistant clerk announced the results.
We have a new chair, Forrest Dunbar.
Congratulations.
Prior to being elected onto the assembly in 2016, Dunbar had run against Congressman Don Young for his House seat. Eric Croft, who represents West Anchorage, was elected to be the new vice chair. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaska-born reporter wins a Pulitzer for reporting on death squads in the Philippines.
And I also hope, you know, this brings a lot more attention back to the Philippines because the drug war is still happening. People are still being killed.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
Kodiak processors and fishermen are seeing the effects of the 80% cut to the cod quota in the Gulf of Alaska. Some small boat fishermen who previously relied on targeting cod are turning to other means in order to make a profit. One way to do that is to join a community-supported fishery, or CSF. That's what some Kodiak jig fishermen are doing to bolster their incomes. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche dropped by St. Herman Harbor and visited one fisherman on his vessel, the Morona, to find out more.
Jig fisherman Darius Kasperzak holds up a scrap piece of iron from World War II. He says he picked it up off a beach and uses it as a weight for his line.
When people are making money cod fishing, you just buy lead weights, but those days are over.
Kasperzak is the president of the Alaska Jig Association and says, like him, a lot of jig fishermen used to make the bulk of their income off cod. And with the decline of cod, he says he's seen the association drop from around 40 members to 15 or 16. Kasperzak says where he once harvested rockfish in the summer to diversify his catch, it's now his target species. And he says he's been pulling in fewer rockfish just recently.
We can no longer continue to do business on a volume orientated business model because the volume just isn't there anymore. You have to get paid more for less fish. It's the only way we can remain in business.
Kasperzak describes a careful process of ensuring the rockfish remains fresh from sea to dock. The goal is to emphasize quality over quantity.
You know, when you held a finished sample in your hands, it was like a piece of ivory soap. It's just white and clear. There's no bruising. There's no gapping.
That's the kind of quality people in the lower 48 are willing to pay for. At least that's what some jig fishermen are banking on. Casper Zack, along with a handful of other fishermen, are selling rockfish to Sitka Salmon Shares, a direct-to-consumer group that markets fresh, sustainably caught product to customers in the Midwest. The organization is also working with a couple of processors around Kodiak, like Global Seafoods. Plant manager Nick Morozov says Global Seafoods had the space available to accommodate the group.
And then we just, in general, didn't want to turn down the small guys in town, and so we decided to take on a project.
And he says with the 80% cut to cod quota this year, it also provides his employees with extra work.
So anything that we could plug up into the empty space there would help. It gives them at least extra couple of hours here and there.
Right now, Sitka Salmon Shares business is not a moneymaker. Morozov says they're breaking even, and they'd like more fishermen and a bigger harvest to make a profit. Ryan Horwath is the Kodiak fleet manager for Sitka Salmon Shares and calls their 4 to 6 fishermen a happy number of participants for the group at this point. But Horwath hopes there could be room to grow in the future.
If we can fill these orders, these early orders, then they are talking about expanding their business to include more species from Kodiak.
He says Sitka Salmon Shares is buying more rockfish out of Kodiak this year after a preliminary purchase in 2017. That's good news for fishermen targeting rockfish. Horwath says Sitka Salmon Shares offers vessels around $1 a pound for the fish, which is at least twice the profit Kodiak jig fishermen would usually make on rockfish, if not more. And while Horwath is optimistic about getting other processors involved, he says companies may give priority to more profitable operations. Breaking even might not be enough in the long run. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
No herring biomass was spotted during the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's aerial survey of the Togiak District on Monday, but biologists are still predicting an early start for the Togiak Sacro herring fishery. KDLG's Izzy Ross has more.
This year, Togiak could see one of the earliest herring harvests ever recorded. That's according to Alaska Department of Fish and Game area biologist Tim Sands.
I expect we'll be seeing herring by the 20th. If not sooner, you know.
They didn't see any herring on the April 13th or April 16th surveys, but April 20th would be the Togiak fishery's second earliest start on record. The earliest recorded data biomass was spotted in the district was April 14th, 2016, but because of the unusual timing, fishing only began 3 days later. Herring spawn timing depends largely on water temperature on the spawning grounds, and a warm spring means an early biomass arrival. The total forecasted biomass for 2018 is 136,756 tons, slightly higher than last year's forecast of 130,852 tons.
We have a 20% exploitation rate, so there's 27,351 tons available to harvest.
Of the predicted available harvest, 1,500 tons is allocated to the spawn on the kelp fishery, 1,810 tons is allocated to the Dutch Harbor food and bait fishery, which is harvested in July. The remainder of the predicted harvest is split between Togiak's purse seine and gillnet fisheries. This year, the Togiak fishery has 19 purse seine and 3 gillnet vessels. The purse seine fishery quota is 16,829 tons, or 70%, and the gillnet fishery quota is 7,212 tons, or 30%.
We look at amount of catch in each age class and forecast a population for that age class. By doing that year in and year out, we can look and see how much we think the age class is each year, and that helps us fine-tune the model.
This year, the ADF&G enlisted a statewide herring biologist to lead analysis efforts. The department also moved their model from an Excel spreadsheet to an AD Model Builder program. Sands says that the program allows biologists to change the weights on the data to produce more accurate predictions.
Before, the aerial survey was weighted higher and the age composition data was weighted lower, and we kind of reversed that because we have more confidence in our age composition information than we do in the aerial survey information.
Sands says that preseason talk put prices between $50 and $100 per ton, but he says that it's too early to know for certain.
It's all rumor at this point. It could be higher than that because of Sitka, but it might not make a difference. It all depends.
The Sitka Sacro herring fishery shut down early this year after falling far short of its quota, which may push prices up in other regions. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Thank you.
New charges have been filed against two Petersburg teenagers accused of hitting deer with their vehicle this winter. KFSK's Angela Denning reports.
The case involves 17-year-old Sebastian Davis and 17-year-old Jasmine Omer, who allegedly hit deer with Davis's truck in February. Omer recorded it on video and posted it on the social media app Snapchat. The video shows the vehicle approaching and then hitting two deer. Omer is heard laughing, and Davis is heard saying that they got two of them. It takes place in a residential neighborhood in Petersburg. Alaska State Wildlife Troopers investigated, and the state of Alaska charged each of the teens with harassing game. Davis was additionally charged for reckless driving, all misdemeanors. On Monday, the state of Alaska filed two additional charges against the teenagers, one count each of unlawfully taking game from a motorized vehicle, and two counts each of failing to notify state troopers after colliding with the deer, all misdemeanors. The new charges stem from the state of Alaska changing prosecutors. The case moved from the district attorney's office in Sitka to the special prosecution's office in Anchorage. Assistant Attorney General Aaron Peterson is the new prosecutor. The teens each have their own lawyers representing them. When Davis and Omer were initially questioned by troopers, the teenagers said they were trying to scare the deer for fun and weren't trying to hit the deer. They admitted to hitting a third deer the night before when Omer was driving. They say the deer jumped out in front of their truck. Troopers found deer hair on the truck and a broken headlight on the driver's side. The teens say none of the deer died from what they saw. They say the two deer they hit in the video ran off into a yard. They say the third deer lay down in the road and then got up and walked towards the beach. The arraignment on the new charges is set for April 23rd at the Petersburg Courthouse. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
State wildlife officers say they've closed the case on what they call one of the most egregious examples of deer poaching in southeast Alaska. KTOO's Matt Miller has this report from Juneau.
Most of the defendants, including an Anaka Bay charter operator, have pled guilty or no contest to the charges and must pay fines and restitution. The operation dates back over 2 years ago when a conscientious Alaskan hunter tipped off Alaska wildlife troopers. Trooper Jake Abbott took the lead on the investigation. Others from wildlife troopers, Alaska state troopers, and National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Office of Law Enforcement helped out as the case mushroomed. After tallying over a dozen illegally taken deer, Abbott says he pretty much stopped counting.
And with this case and the length of the investigation, you know, I finally just kind of reached a point where I just had to say, okay, I need to stop kind of poking the hornet's nest and just get people charged. Because what often happens is through the course of these investigations, we take investigatory steps such as getting search warrants and stuff. And usually through the course of that, we end up finding other violations that have been committed.
Abbott says the hunting violations included shooting from a boat, exceeding the bag limit, and abusing the proxy hunting system for elders and the disabled. He says the poachers evaded answering their questions because they knew what they were doing was wrong. Most of the violations occurred during the fall 2015 deer hunting season near Chichikov Island's Elfin Cove and on Admiralty Island's Glass Peninsula.
Pretty popular hunting area. It's an area that can be harder to get to, especially later in the season if people don't have adequate boats, because the Taku Inlet area can be a pretty nasty piece of water.
Abbott says all of the defendants either were co-workers or somehow acquainted with each other.
With these people, these are all avid outdoorsmen. For the majority of them, they were all, you know, involved in either the sport fishing industry as guides, or they're all avid hunters.
Abbott says they conducted interviews, served search warrants on the defendants' homes, and combed social media for trophy shot pictures.
It's hard to look for just one thing or to have your mindset on just one thing. I mean, you never know what might be that little piece of evidence, that little nugget of gold that kind of sends you over the edge as far as being able to make a case or not. So that was kind of the instance here where we just kept finding little nuggets of gold and more little nuggets of gold, and then people's statements corroborating what we were seeing or not seeing.
43-year-old Grantley Moore of Juneau pled guilty in February to misdemeanor charges of unlawful possession, providing false information on a hunt report, and taking an overlimit of deer.
I've been pretty much fishing my entire life. I'm Grantley Moore, and I own Moore Charters. I grew up out in the middle of nowhere in Tenneke Springs, which is about 70 miles west of Juneau.
That's from a video posted on moorcharters.com. Investigators determined that many of the deer hunting trips occurred on Moore's charter vessel, Eclipse. Moore did not return messages placed at his business seeking comment. As part of a plea agreement with prosecutors, charges of taking big game from a boat and unlawful possession or transportation of game were dropped. Moore was fined a total of $3,500 in order to pay the state $1,600 in restitution for illegally harvesting four deer. He was also put on probation for a year and lost his hunting privileges for 2 years. 24-year-old Tyler Matthews of Juneau pled guilty in February to unlawful possession, taking big game from a boat, and as a non-resident harvesting deer as a proxy when prohibited. As part of a plea agreement, the misdemeanor charges were reduced to violations, and additional charges of unlawful proxy hunting and unlawful game possession or transportation were dropped. Matthews was fined a total of $900 in order to pay the state $800 in restitution for illegally harvesting two deer. Matthews could not be reached for comment. Others charged in the case include 30-year-old Benjamin Olson, 24-year-old Mackenzie Wilson, and 25-year-old Wyatt Weimer, all of Juneau. They earlier pled no contest at arraignment to violations of taking big game from a boat, unlawful possession, and unlawful proxy hunting. They were each ordered to pay fines up to $1,600 and restitution of as much as $800. There are two other defendants with unresolved cases. 22-year-old Daniel Collins of Oklahoma did not appear in court, and a $500 arrest warrant has been issued. 25-year-old Anis Sadihi of Juneau awaits trial starting May 22nd. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
A news reporter born and raised in Alaska took home one of journalism's top honors this week. Claire Baldwin and two of her colleagues with the Reuters news agency won the Pulitzer Prize for international reporting for their series on a brutal ongoing drug war in the Philippines. As Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reports, Baldwin's work as a journalist has taken her from the Mat-Su to the bloody streets of Manila.
Before spending a year and a half reporting on death squads, Claire Baldwin says she had seen maybe one dead body, and that was in a casket at a funeral. But a big part of Baldwin's mission was to show the pattern behind why more and more Filipinos were showing up dead on city streets. Baldwin, 34 and a graduate of Colony High School in Palmer, says it was difficult but important.
Yeah, there's a lot of deaths and blood and guts, and you have to kind of keep in mind why you're there. And you're there to tell a story about what's happening.
What was happening, and what Baldwin says is still happening, is a drug war under Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte that has been marked by thousands of extrajudicial killings. Duterte says the killings by his government's anti-drug squads are justified, but they have been condemned by international human rights groups. The hard-nosed reporting by Baldwin, her colleagues, and others added a greater depth to news of the ongoing violence. It has also given their international audience a better sense of the actual numbers of deaths and the impacts to the families left behind.
And I also hope, you know, this brings a lot more attention back to the Philippines, because the drug war is still happening. People are still being killed. These families are still asking for justice. And there are a lot of really wonderful local reporters that are still covering this.
Baldwin was once a local reporter, too. That was before college at Stanford, before she became a special correspondent in Southeast Asia for Reuters, and before moving to Hong Kong, where she lives on a boat. She was still in high school when she reported for the Mat-Su Valley Frontiersman. She also worked for the Fairbanks Daily Newsminer and the Peninsula Clarion. And among other outdoor activities, Baldwin did some mountaineering with her dad. She says growing up in Alaska shaped her as a person and helped her in many ways.
The ability to improvise, or the desire to improvise, being comfortable and kind of uncomfortable places, you know, because the more you can just sort of deal with yourself and be comfortable for long periods of time in rough conditions, the better. Like, you'll do a better job.
Baldwin's parents, Ralph Baldwin and Susan Gunther, still live in Wasilla. They say they were proud and pleasantly surprised to get what they described as a typically understated announcement from their daughter this week about the Pulitzer. Considering the subject matter of the reporting, they both say they are concerned sometimes about her safety on reporting trips abroad, poking around such violent circumstances. But both parents say Baldwin has proven she's capable of taking care of herself with good judgment and a good sense of risk management. Susan says they strive to teach their children to be independent, critical thinkers.
Sometimes when you raise your kids to be independent, the downfall is that they do take off and they end up in different parts of the world. But, you know, we're really proud of them. And when we can see them, we're thrilled.
Baldwin does make it back to Alaska to visit from time to time, but she is currently working on another reporting project, this time in Bangladesh, telling the stories of hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing persecution and, again, reports of government-sanctioned killing. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
The High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, or HARP, facility is gearing up for its busiest season since the University of Alaska Fairbanks acquired the Gakona Area Atmospheric Experimentation Station from the Air Force. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
HARP Director Jessica Matthews says she and her staff and UAF officials are all pretty excited about the third and biggest research campaign the HARP has hosted since the Air Force handed over the facility to the university in 2015.
This one is by far the largest and longest campaign that we've had. It's scheduled for the 6th to the 14th. And we have about 43 hours of funded research that's going to be going on this spring.
During the campaign, top-level research agencies will be paying to use the Upper Atmosphere Research Observatory, which is operated by the UAF Geophysical Institute.
For this particular campaign, the funding agencies are Los Alamos National Lab, the Department of Energy, the Naval Research Lab, Air Force Research Lab, and the National Science Foundation.
The organizations will use HARP's array of dozens of antennas, powerful radio frequency transmitters, and advanced monitoring instrumentation to conduct their experiments, which are similar to the kinds of applied research that's been conducted there for more than a decade.
The goal of the research is the same, which is basically conducting fundamental research or study of the physical processes that are taking place in the very highest portions of our atmosphere, which is called the ionosphere.
She's hopeful the university will, by year's end, gain title to the 1,000 acres on which the Air Force built the facility in 2003 for some $300 million, a facility which the university now operates on a shoestring.
This is a large program. The Air Force ran the program for about $7 million a year. The university is really doing an extraordinary job, and we're running it just at about $2 million a year.
Matthews says she and her staff are also planning this year's open house, scheduled for August 25th. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Rasha McChesney and Matt Miller in Juneau, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Andrew Kitchenman in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Curious about your alcohol habits or those of someone you care about? Find a free and confidential alcohol screening at recoveralaska.org or call 211 today. This Alcohol Awareness Month, Recover Alaska reminds us that together we are stronger than alcohol addiction. Recover Alaska is a trusted source for alcohol research and resources, including an index of local available treatment options. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska. Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.